Hello, it's Debbie back on Washington's birthday, 2/22/17, with the Decatur Herald and Review. And starting on the first page, above the fold, if any edition folded, called On Her Personal Trail. This is by Teresa Churchill, which, as you know, is a senior writer for H&R. Decatur native finds freedom on the Appalachian Trail. Asked Lila Pels what city she lives in, and she's apt to reply, "Huh, I don't know. I'm a bit of a nomad." The 30-year-old Decatur native has earned that moniker having just hiked the 65-mile section of the Appalachian Trail that wildfires forced her to skip last year during her 4.5-month, 2,100-plus-mile journey. Aha. It took 3.5 days to go from Dix Creek Gap near Hiawassee, Georgia, to the Nantahala Outdoor Center near Bryson City, North Carolina, where she wrapped up Monday afternoon. I know that officially I completed the miles December 2nd, but that section was eating away at my conscience, Peltz said Tuesday in a telephone interview from Franklin, North Carolina. I had to go back and finish. It was perhaps the same drive and desire for excellence that led her to New York City after earning a Master of Fine Arts in Costume Production in 2014 from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. In New York, while working for a commercial costume shop and running wardrobe for The Lion King on Broadway, she realized she was unhappy. It was too busy, too crowded, too bright and loud, she said. I was working all the time, and this is not how you're supposed to live. Pels found refuge in remembering a childhood of spending every 4th of July weekend in western North Carolina with her family. She is the youngest of four children born to Jerry and Carol Pels of Decatur, Pels, P-E-L-Z. Walking the portion of the Appalachian Trail that ran nearby was such a happy memory. Leah Pels decided that hiking the whole thing was just the change of pace she needed. She actually had to work twice as hard for another year to save up enough money to make it happen. However, after the lease on her apartment was up June 30, she had her mother drive her to Baxter State Park in Maine, and the northernmost point of the trail is at Mount Catahoulin. Pell set off on July 11th, unable to wait and do what most people do, which is start at Springer Mountain in Georgia in the spring and go north. I don't like to do the things the way other people do, she said. Her average mileage varied greatly depending on the terrain, the weather, and the water supply, but she tried to cover at least 20 miles a day, sometimes alone and sometimes with other hikers. She kept 3 to 5 days' worth of supplies in her pack, replenished them from nearby towns, and stayed in shelters along the trail or in the tent she carried with her. It's not like I was seeking solutions to life or anything, Pell said. It was nice to have nearly 5 months where all I really needed to worry about was, am I going to be warm and dry, and do I have enough food, and is there a good water source nearby? Everything was much more under my control. With all the usual life stressors off the table, such as jobs and bills, Pels found she could connect with the people she met on the trail more quickly and on a deeper level. It allows you to get down to the topics that are really actually important and really matter, she said. Spending one day on a trail with somebody is like knowing them for several months. The closest Pels came to a fire was November 25th at Newfound Gap between Tennessee and North Carolina in the Great Smoky Mountains. At that point, it was a new fire, but it was the one that burned Gatlinburg, she said. She and her companions hiked about a mile and a half with bandanas over their noses and mouths before the smoke cleared. Pels also wore out two pairs of shoes on the trek and broke in a third. After spending Christmas in Decatur, Pels had used her sister's cabin near Newland, North Carolina, as a base while working odd jobs and figuring out what happens next. She hopes to hike the 500-mile Colorado Trail next summer after spending a few weeks creating costumes for the Utah Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City. The freedom of having everything I needed on my back was awesome, and I want that feeling back again, Pell said. I've never been happier. So that's the end of that article. Next semester, I may be repeating myself, but I goofed up on recording a little bit, and I apologize. Next semester, the tuition for standard district students will be 133 per hour, an increase of 4 from the current year at Richland. Tuition for students taking health professions and online classes will go up $5 starting next year to $160 and $168, respectively. Officials said the challenge of the tuition change was to bring in more money while keeping Richland a viable financial option for local residents. With the trend we have right now and the challenges we have financially, we thought this would be a good mix, Richland President Chris Valdez said. We're seeing a nominal tuition increase while also staying at a competitive range with our sister institutions. With tuition fees, the total cost for a standard in-district student would total $145 per credit hour. Total tuition and fees costs for students in health profession and online classes would be $172 per credit hour and $180 per credit hour, respectively. The total cost for out-of-district students would be $200 per credit hour, while out-of-state students' total cost would be $481 per credit hour. The in-district costs for Richland students align with several other community colleges in central Illinois, including Heartland's total cost of $146 per credit hour, Lakeland College's total cost of $131 per hour, and Lincoln Land College's total cost of $132 per credit hour. In addition to tuition, the board also approved changing several fees for classes. Most stayed the same, though some, such as chemistry and everyday life, saw an increase. The tuition increase is part of an effort by the college to get its financial situation in order. Due to declining enrollment and loss of state funds that used to account for roughly 13% of the college's budget, officials have had to look at ways to avoid a budget hole, which Valdez projected to be more than $250,000 in the coming fiscal year. In the past few months, the college has eliminated several administrative positions. Also, employees are being offered voluntary buyout packages. The number of employees who have accepted buyout should be known by the board's March meeting. End of that article. On to the third of four front-page articles. Del Carmen's likely to be rebuilt. May go at site where fire destroyed prior pizza restaurant. This is by Tony Reed, an H&R staff reader. Del Carmen's East will rise again, eventually. The burnt-out Del Carmen's East Pizza restaurant in Decatur will, like one of its fabled crusts, rise again. But it may not be at its former location on North 22nd Street, and the resurrection process could take anywhere from 6 months to a year. Married couple Larry and Martha Stanley, who had run the restaurant for just shy of 30 years before an arson fire set by burglars destroyed it in September, said they most likely won't be the ones managing the new version. Larry Stanley said the couple's two daughters and several other business people are interested in reopening Del Carmen's, and it's a question now of who can be involved in a deal. But for my wife and I, we just turned 74. We don't think that's a time to start over, Stanley said. He also said the original North 22nd Street location was too badly damaged in the fire to be saved, and that building is scheduled to be torn down. He said a neighboring beauty shop and an apartment in a nearby but separate building are in a nearby but separate building and will be unaffected. Whether the new owner will want to rebuild at that location, I don't know, he added. However, I would really suggest putting it back there because most people know that location and we had a good following there. He said an estimated return timeline for the restaurant, whether at North 22nd or elsewhere, ranges anywhere from 6 months to a year from now. There's another Del Carmen's business in town, but it has no connection with the couple. Huh. Stanley said he always tried to keep the pizza recipe, from brand of cheese to tomato sauce to singular crust, as close as possible to the original he acquired with the business. And he said he's convinced that customers appreciated that style of cooking and are eager for it to return. I probably don't have a day go by when I'm out in public and somebody says, "Hey, when are you going to get that pizza place going again?" I just came home from vacation. I had another business guy calling me on the phone wanting to know what I was going to do with the restaurant. There is a lot of interest in Del Carmen's. Customers like Decatur Misty Gazda said they've been going through withdrawal symptoms since fire burned away their favorite pizza option. Gazda, a Florida native, said she got hooked on it while visiting Decatur to date Chris Gazda, the man who became her husband in 2015. She says they built a relationship eating at Del Carmen's. Oh, the sauce, the breadsticks. No other pizza places were the same, said Ms. Misty Gazda, 30. She's glad the place is coming back, even though she may have to grind through another hungry 12 months of waiting and is just thankful she'd gone there to pick up dinner just a week before the arson is struck. Chris and I said, well, at least we got one good fix before we couldn't have it again, she added. As to why someone would call a pizza restaurant Del Carmen's in the first place, there's a lot of stories. Chandler said he thought it meant eat at Carmen's in French. But if that were the case, the restaurant should be called Manger à Carmen. Still, better still, the Italian version would be Mangiare à Carmen. A more likely explanation is the original owner's ex-wife's name was Carmen, and the ex-husband, before they split, told me he liked the Del from Del Monte Foods, and he just put it with Carmen for Del Carmen, Stanley said. End of that article. And now I'm hungry for pizza. All right, last article. Local. Sheriff sees little impact on deportation in Macon County. Schneider says small Hispanic presence will blunt federal policy effort. This is by Ryan Boyles. Decatur. Macon County Sheriff Thomas Schneider learned a lesson early in his career about illegal immigration and deportation. Unless we had an illegal alien on a serious felony, immigration didn't want to hear about it, he said. All that could change soon after a new plan unveiled this week by President Donald Trump. The Trump administration is greatly expanding the number of people living in the U.S. illegally who are considered a priority for deportation, including people arrested for traffic violations, according to agency documents released Tuesday. The decision represents a sweeping rewrite of the nation's immigration enforcement priorities. The Homeland Security Department memos signed by Secretary John Kelly indicate that any immigrant living in the United States illegally who has been charged or convicted of any crime, and even those suspected of a crime, will now be an enforcement priority. That could include people arrested for shoplifting or minor traffic offenses. The memos eliminate far more narrow guidance issued under the Obama administration that focused strictly on immigrants who had been convicted of serious crimes, threats to national security, and recent border crossings. Past policies on immigration for local officials have been, in the words of Schneider, disheartening. Specifically, he recalls a case just a year ago when an illegal immigrant was being held in Macon County Jail in connection with a sexual assault case. But immigration took little interest when Schneider contacted him about the case, and the individual soon bonded out of jail. If you had a family member who was a victim of sexual assault, and you knew the person suspected of that sexual assault was illegal, and I told you that they just bonded out of jail, I think that as a family member or a person in the community, you think, well, that just isn't right, Schneider said. Well, that happened right here locally. Unlike other cities, Schneider said contacts his department has with illegal immigrants are few and far between. At most, his department deals with a handful of cases per month and even fewer that are serious crimes. The number of cases is not a big surprise, considering the demographics of the Decatur area. The Hispanic population in the area is little more than 2%, according to the U.S. Census Bureau's 2010 data. The percentage is well below the national average of 17%. Regardless, Schneider said his office will follow the guidelines set by the federal government and police as his office sees fit. The national directives do not have any impact on President Barack Obama's program that protected more than 750,000 young immigrants from deportation. The deferred action for childhood arrivals remains in place, though immigrants in the program will still be eligible for deportation if they commit a crime or are otherwise deemed to be a threat to public safety or national security, according to the department. End of that article, end of that first page. An announcement for a fun activity. Painting is just gotten more fun, and perhaps you know somebody that might be interested in this. Under the announcements on page 2 is tomorrow's highlight. Masters in Merlot, 6 to 8, Gallery 510, Arts Guild Limited. Barbara Dove leads class with garden painting by Monet. All materials, light snacks, and wine provided, all for $30. Continuing with the A section into local, city rethinks energy plan. Council decides bids too high for converting lights to LED system. High bids drive Decatur Council's delay of energy savings project. That's the end of the headlines. This is by Chris Losvardi from the staff there at H&R. The brakes were put on a project Tuesday that would have increased the energy efficiency of lighting in Decatur. The City Council voted 6-1 to reject two bids received as part of an LED retrofit project that had drawn interest to make the state grant funding To make use of the state grant funding, City Manager Tim Gleason asked for more time to allow city staff to revisit the issue after the bids came in higher than expected. It's still a great project for the city, Gleason said. In order to receive a $250,000 state grant, the city learned in late December, Gleason said the work would have to be done by May. A first round of bids included a penalty imposed on companies for not completing the work on time, he said. The penalty was removed the second round, which the council voted on, but Gleason said the bid still came in $750,000 to $1 million higher than projected. The city had expected the project to cost about $700,000, he said. We have questions we've only begun to ask, Gleason said. Robert Edgisley of Edgisley Electric, which was one of the bidders, told the council the company's bid included new fixtures instead of retrofitting the existing ones. Edgisley wanted more explanation from city officials as to why the bids were being set aside, but he had not been able to arrange a meeting. The state grant is as high a priority now, as Gleason said, further opportunities could be made available. The city could still expect to receive a return on investment for any work that's done. Councilwoman Lisa Gregory voted against rejecting the bids. She was excited for the project and disappointed at the rejection. Councilman Pat McDaniel said with limited city funding, receiving state money could be important. He wants staff to proceed without hindering additional opportunities to receive state assistance. Councilwoman Diana Bray said she couldn't approve bids that were substantially higher than what the city has sought. It changes the whole scope of the project, Ray said. Gleason said a proposal could be presented to the council again by late March. The city is trying to manage its energy use, which could include more control over when lights are turned on, as resident John O'Brien suggested. O'Brien said LED lights can be useful, but he urged the council to be careful in the application of new lighting. End of it. It's not an article, but a caption that's quite informative. The picture is just of a building apparently getting its roof on. It by Jim Bowling of the Herald and Review. Workers nail panels and boards on the roof of the new HSHS Medical Group Family Medicine building at the corner of Mount Zion Road and Lost Bridge Road. The 12,000 square foot facility is expected to be open in July. Medical staff will relocate from a family practice clinic in Mount Zion. And then, as strike votes tallied, state union schedules prayer rally for Saturday. No walkout plan, but AFSCME members to meet in Southern Illinois. Southern Illinois state workers pray for resolution to budget crisis. This is by Molly Parker, Lee News Service writer, Vienna. A group of state workers is planning a prayer rally Saturday as the state budget impasse drags on. My Brother's Keeper is hosting the event at 10 a.m. at the Vienna City Park, not far from the Shawnee Correctional Center and Vienna Correctional Center. By the end of the week, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees expected to announce the results of the first ever statewide strike authorization vote, as talks with Governor Bruce Rauner's administration have been in a standstill for more than a year. AFSCMS, I think. Okay. An affirmative vote would not mean a strike is imminent, but it would give the bargaining committee the ability to call one if AFSCME leaders seem it necessary, said union spokesman Anders Lindahl. But an affirmative majority would undoubtedly intensify the feud with Rauner. Marcia Griffin, who organized the faith-based rally in Vienna, did not mention the strike authorization vote, but said the event was meant to show support for correction employees in dangerous jobs. Griffin, who ran for state representative in 2016, said she organized the upcoming activity, quote, because I want to provide workers through our state a time to gather in solidarity and provide them with a day of hope as we gather to pray for our state. Southern Illinois workers in a pray for our state. Southern Illinois workers in a resolution to the budget crisis. It's vital the budget impasse is ended so we can attract industry and experience job creation. End quote. AFSCME was among Griffin's biggest organizational supporters in her Illinois General Assembly campaign. A strike authorization could lead to chaos at some of the largest facilities in southern Illinois that provide critical services for vulnerable people, including Choate Mental Health and Development Center and Illinois Veterans Home of Anna, Chester Mental Health, and Warren G. Murray Developmental Center in Centralia. State employees who help people sign up for food benefits and Medicaid could also walk off the job if a strike were to be called. The law prohibits correctional officers and lieutenants at state prisons, boot camps, and juvenile justice facilities from striking, and instead would lead to a binding arbitration as it relates to those specific job classifications. But prisons also could be affected by a walkout, as non-security support services personnel are not prohibited from striking. Lindahl said all union workers at mental health facilities would have the legal ability to walk off the job in the event of a strike, even though people in these facilities have been court-ordered for treatment following involvement with the criminal justice system or through civil commitment process because it's been determined they could be a danger to themselves or others. The administration would have the right to hire temporary workers willing to cross a picket line. Dennis Marashko, the governor's general counsel, said Rauner could fill spots by mobilizing the Illinois National Guard. However, the governor's office has not released any specific plan as how it might respond to a strike. Catherine Kelly, a Rauner spokeswoman, said, "Hope AFSCME chooses not to strike over the administration's contract that includes a 40-hour work week, merit pay, and use of volunteers, and therefore remain committed on working with the union to implement the terms of the contract that's similar to contracts ratified by 20 other unions," unquote. One of the main issues in the dispute is the employee cost of health care. The governor declared an impasse last year and was upheld by the Illinois Labor Relations Board. The impasse declaration is the subject of a pending legal battle. AFSCME strike authorization voting concluded this past weekend. The statewide tally will take place in an undisclosed location, with results expected by the end of the week. End of that article. Next article. Judge: police rights violation negates evidence. Rules arrest timing did not legally follow search warrant terms. Drug evidence tossed out by judge. This is by Tony Reed for the Herald and Review. Decatur: a judge has ruled that seized evidence, 27 pounds of cannabis and a quarter kilogram of cocaine, cannot be used in the prosecution of a Decatur man. In a February 15th ruling handed out in Macon County Circuit Court, the judge agreed with a defense motion that the constitutional rights of Keith Halliburton had been violated. His lawyers now say he should be released from custody, and a hearing on that issue is set for Thursday. Nicole Kroenke, first assistant state's attorney with the Macon County State's Attorney's Office, said the ruling will be appealed soon. She said she had no other comment. The crucial point the case turned on is the moment when Decatur police executed a search warrant against Halliburton, 37, who was arrested in March and accused of being a major drug dealer. Working with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, police said they intercepted a 19-pound cannabis shipment and two parcels sent to Decatur. Having determined drugs were inside, tracking devices and electronic alerts that indicate when parcels have been opened were inserted. Police then conducted a controlled delivery of the parcels, and Halliburton's lawyers say he was seen picking them up, putting them in a vehicle, and later transferring them to another vehicle. Defense attorney Ton Ringel said that the police had been issued with a, quote, anticipatory search warrant, quote, which allowed them to search when a triggering event, the opening of the packages, took place. Ringel of the Johnson Law Group argued police jumped the gun by stopping and arresting Halliburton and searching his vehicle before the packages had been opened. Ringel said that was a violation of Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable search and seizure. Todd Ringel provided case law to the presiding judge, clearly demonstrating that not waiting for this triggering event violated Halliburton's constitutional rights, his law firm said in a statement Tuesday. At the time, police had also seized an additional 8 pounds of cannabis they said they'd found in the vehicle, along with 328 grams of cocaine. Having suppressed much of the physical evidence, Ringel said the judge also ruled that all evidence, quote, derived from, unquote, the seized drugs include allegedly incriminating statements made to police by Halliburton, which would not be admissible at court at trial either. End of that article. I find that a bit confusing. Continuing on this page, a nice little article, Lincoln Museum to showcase Cub-Cardinals rivalry. AP out of Springfield. The historic and longtime struggle between the Chicago Cubs and the St. Louis Cardinals will be a subject of an exhibit at Springfield's Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum starting next month. Quote, Cubs versus Cardinals, the rivalry, unquote, was developed with the help of both teams in the National Baseball Hall of Fame and opens March 24th. Museum officials said it will feature rare artifacts and photographs and span players from Mordecai Brown and Roger Hornsby to recent stars such as Jake Arrieta and Yadier Molina. Hall of Fame President Jeff Idelson said the intent of the exhibit is to, quote, animate the stories associated with one of the baseball's most celebrated rivalries and two of the most enthusiastic fan bases these teams represent, unquote. Items planned for the exhibit include the second base bag stolen by the Cardinals' Lou Brock to break the modern record for steals in a season, and the cap worn by Cubs pitcher Kerry Wood when he struck out 20 batters. Baseball fans also will be able to interact with the exhibit and share their own rivalry memories, answer trivia questions, and play a home run derby. Museum officials said the exhibit will span 150 years, highlighting the team's famous broadcasters, championships, trades, and home run races. There's no extra fee to see the displays. A series of special events is also planned, including a talk from an expert on the Civil War era, baseball, and screening of the movie Field of Dreams. End of that article. And then to end this section, I think we've got briefs for Wednesday. Mattoon, armed robbery arrest. Police arrested a Charleston man after an armed robbery Sunday at an apartment complex. Kenneth W. Moultrie, Jr., 21, was taken to custody early Monday and charged with home evasion, armed robbery, and aggravated battery with a deadly weapon. The victim alleged that several of the men struck him with guns when he refused to comply. He was treated for cuts to heads and face. Next, Decatur, blood donations. The American Red Cross is holding blood donation opportunities at several sites in the Decatur area in late February, early March. A blood donor card, a driver's license, or two other forms of identification are required at check-in. Potential donors must be 17 years old, 16 with a parental consent, weigh at least 110 pounds, and be in good health. To make appointment, download the Red Cross Blood Donor app, visit redcross.org, or call 1-800-733-2767. 800-733-2767. And I'm pretty sure you do not have to have an appointment, although sometimes it gets you in quicker if there's a bunch of people. The opportunities include Tuesday, February 28th in the afternoon, noon to 5:30 at the Monticello United Methodist Church on Washington Street. Then 2 to 6 at the Decatur Blood Donation Center on Main Street. On Thursday, March 2nd, noon to 6, Decatur Blood Donation Center. Friday, March 3rd, 9 to 1:30, Moroa Forsyth High School on Washington Street in Moroa. And Saturday, March 4th, 7 to 11 at the First United Methodist Church. That's the end of that article, but I'd say, you know, if you're interested in giving, just calling the Blood Center about location would do it. Springfield, Mellencamp at Fair. John Mellencamp in Alabama are among the first headliners announced for the 2017 Illinois State Fair. Others announced headlines are Chase Rice, Jason Derulo, and Five Finger Death Punch. So then, that's pretty exciting. Then finally, Decatur, Mommy Son Night. Mommy and Son Play Night will be from 6 to 9 on Friday, March 3rd, at Decatur Indoor Sports Center on Wood Street. Boys age 5 to 10 and their mothers will have active play, music, a bounce house, rock wall climbing, photo booth, pizza, and prizes. Check-in is from 6 to 6:30, pizza served from 6:30 to 7:30, and play from 6 to 9. Fee is $20 per couple with $5 for additional sibling. You can register by phone with the Decatur Indoor Sports Center or at the center on March 2nd, which is the day before. Okay, this is the end of part one of the Decatur Herald and Review is read by Debbie off the computer with the e-edition on Wednesday, Washington's birthday. I'll be back talking to you soon.